Europe is a continent that, to my count, has 41 currently active territorial disputes between different countries going on within it, ranging from mild to moderate to serious levels of controversy. To start this video off, we're going to go through the list of Europe's mild disputes first before moving on to the more serious ones, which are disputes that don't involve any actually inhabited territories, involve very small amounts of essentially inconsequential territory, and are in most of these cases so small scale and low key that most of the residents in the countries involved aren't even aware that the disputes even exist in the first place. The first of these more mild and arguably goofy disputes is between France and Italy, and concerns who between them actually owns the summit of Mont Blanc, the highest mountain in the Alps and the highest point located anywhere in Europe outside of the Caucasus mountain range. When you look closely at the French-Italian border here that runs along the crest of the mountains, you'll notice these two small areas that are in dispute between them. The Italian-claimed border follows the natural watershed here and splits the summit of Western Europe's highest mountain evenly between them, while the French-claimed border simply deviates ever so slightly from the natural watershed to incorporate the entire summit of Mont Blanc within France instead, thus enabling France to insist on sole ownership of the mountain's summit and Western Europe's highest peak without sharing it with the Italians. Italy insists that the 1860 Treaty of Turin, signed between France and the Kingdom of Sardinia, in which France annexed the Duchy of Savoy, established the modern border between France and Italy after Italy was unified the following year in 1861. But then, 4 years later, in 1865, the Italians allege that France moved their idea of the border on the mountain unilaterally so as to fully incorporate the summit into French territory, which Italy has never accepted and continually rejected for nearly the past 160 years now, leading to the current state of small but prideful territorial disputes between them. Germany is a country that historically had many territorial disputes all throughout Europe, but today really only has two, thankfully very minor disputes. The first of which is with the Netherlands here in the estuary of the Ems River. The bay here between the Netherlands and Germany is known as the Dollart, and it is fully on the western side of the Ems River. Germany legally regards the maritime border between them here and the Dollart Bay as running from the recognized land border here entirely along the left bank of the Ems River, essentially following the Dutch shoreline out into the North Sea. The Netherlands maintains a different legal view, however, and counter-insists that the maritime border between them here follows the river's Thalweg, or in other words, the roughly center line that follows the lowest elevation within the river's valley, which leaves a narrow maritime area between their claims that both countries maintain an open dispute over. At a high-level meeting in 2014, the foreign ministers of Germany and the Netherlands finally met to settle this long-running and hotly contentious dispute once and for all, and they basically just agreed to disagree. They agreed that the maritime border here between them would simply remain ambiguous and undefined, with each side sharing a mutual legal responsibility over the area instead of actually coming up with any hard definitions, meaning that the disputed border here will likely remain for the foreseeable future. And Germany's other active ongoing territorial dispute today is somehow even less controversial than that. Here in the far southwest of Germany lies Lake Constance, a large alpine lake where the borders of Germany, Austria, and Switzerland all converge at. Now, weirdly, when you look at this lake in Google Maps, you'll notice that the borders of all three of these countries immediately end the moment they reach the lake's shoreline, as opposed to the borders shown that crisscross other lakes in the region nearby, like Lake Geneva and Lake Maggiore. On Lake Constance, the borders are shown to end the moment the borders reach the lake, because the lake itself is the subject of a territorial dispute. Austria's legal position is that the entire lake is 100% jointly co-owned and shared by all three of the countries around it, making the whole lake a sort of condominium with free and equal access to all three countries around it. Switzerland, however, doesn't agree with this viewpoint, owing to the fact that Austria controls the smallest amount of coastline on the lake. And so, they argue instead that the international borders between all three countries here run down the center line of the lake, with Switzerland and Germany controlling most of the lake, and Austria limited to only a sliver of it around their immediate coastline. Meanwhile, Germany maintains no official legal opinion on the borders in the lake at all, and takes a deliberately neutral stance between the differing positions of Austria and Switzerland, leaving the lake behind as a very low-level controversy between all three. The next minor dispute in Europe is over on the other side of the continent and concerns the status of an island called Kay Island between Ukraine and Romania, making up Ukraine's much, much, much lower intensity territorial dispute with a country that begins with R. The problem here is that Kay Island is a relatively new landmass that only began forming naturally in the early 2000s in the Black Sea, right at the mouth of the Danube River that mostly forms the border between Ukraine and Romania. This border here has long been the established border between the two states that was agreed upon between the Soviet Union and Romania in 1948, and then re-agreed upon again after Ukraine became independent with the Romanian-Ukrainian Border Treaty of 1997. Unfortunately, as Kay Island began forming shortly after that treaty in the early 2000s, the international border cut across the northern tip of the island, which led the Ukrainians to unilaterally alter their interpretation of the border in 2010 to fully encompass the new island within Ukrainian territory, which Romanian authorities have objected to ever since, but since the island is uninhabited, tiny, and has barely even existed for more than 20 years, hardly anybody really cares about it. Moving on, another tiny island that a bunch of countries in Europe maintain a dispute over is up here in the North Atlantic called Rockall. And as its name sort of implies, it's really less of an island and more of just a big rock in the middle of the ocean. With the legal status of a rock that's uninhabitable, no state can really claim it as an island and benefit from the large maritime EEZ area that would normally go along with it. Rockall is indisputably located within the EEZ of the UK, but it's also located in a geographically weird area where the EEZs of Ireland, Iceland, and Denmark by way of the Danish-owned Faroe Islands all roughly converge at. The dispute here around Rockall, therefore, isn't so much over the maritime boundaries above the sea, but on the access to the ocean floor beneath the sea on the continental shelf. Because all four of these countries technically claim the seafloor beneath Rockall as a natural extension of their continental shelves. The ownership of the continental shelf rights around Rockall are valuable, because they would enable whichever state who owns them the exclusive rights to harvest any resources that could potentially be located down there on the seafloor, like oil and gas. And so, it's the ownership of these kinds of rights around Little Rockall that all four of these European countries dispute to this day. And now we're going to dip our toes into the area of Europe with the highest concentration of ongoing territorial disputes, the Balkans. One of the more minor territorial disputes here at the moment concerns Croatia and Montenegro, who, despite only bordering each other with a tiny border length of just 25 kilometers, have still managed to fit in a dispute there anyway. The issue between them here stems over the status of the small Prevlaka Peninsula here, the southernmost point of Croatia that strategically juts out into the entrance of the Montenegrin-owned Bay of Kotor. During the breakup of Yugoslavia in the 1990s, the Serbian and Montenegrin forces attempted to capture the Prevlaka Peninsula from Croatia, along with the rest of the Adriatic coastline here, up to the important city of Dubrovnik, which was put to siege by them for months between 1991 and 1992, with the then Montenegrin Prime Minister asserting that Dubrovnik was rightfully Montenegrin. By the end of 1992, however, the Croatian army had managed to break the siege of Dubrovnik and recaptured the whole coastline, including the strategic Prevlaka Peninsula, which then led to the Croatian and Montenegrin sides mutually agreeing on keeping the Prevlaka Peninsula a demilitarized zone, and led to UN Security Council Resolution 779, which affirmed the demilitarized status of the Prevlaka Peninsula and placed a UN peacekeeping force there to basically keep the peninsula as a UN buffer zone area between them. At the end of 2002, a decade later, the UN-mandated peacekeeping mission on the peninsula ended and it was fully returned back to Croatia again, which led to Croatia and Montenegro signing what was intended to only be a temporary arrangement in regards to the handover. This supposedly temporary agreement recognized the return of the peninsula to Croatia, but also stipulated that in order to maintain the peninsula's demilitarized status going forward, the sea bay on the eastern side of the peninsula up to the Croatian border was to remain strictly off limits as a sort of no-man's zone with unrecognized territorial claims. And decades later now, that temporary agreement has continued remaining theoretically in force, even after both Croatia and Montenegro have joined the NATO alliance, with Montenegro still not recognizing Croatia's territorial waters in the bay here. And that's far from the only maritime dispute that Croatia has gotten itself involved in. It's pretty well known by most geography geeks that Croatia almost completely landlocks Bosnia and Herzegovina by its control of virtually the entire northeastern Adriatic coastline, with the sole exception of this tiny corridor that's fewer than 5 kilometers wide centered on the Bosnian port of Neum, that grants Bosnia and Herzegovina its only tiny access out to the sea. The corridor in Neum also separates Croatian territory into two separate halves, with a northern mainland and a southern semi-exclave centered around the city of Dubrovnik. There isn't any part of these borders that is openly in dispute today, but between 2018 and 2022, the Croatians spent 420 million euros constructing a major bridge project here that they called the Peljašac Bridge, which finally linked up their two disconnected halves by land and enabled Croatians for the first ever time to drive over land between them without having to pass through Bosnian territory first. The bridge has also been very deeply controversial within Bosnia and Herzegovina, however, because it was built directly across the channel of their only sea access to the global ocean, contributing to their sense of being landlocked by Croatia even further. Croatia agreed to build the bridge to a height of 55 meters, which enables all but the absolute biggest of container and cruise ships to continue passing under the bridge and accessing the Bosnian port in Neum. But several Bosnian officials have still noted that the bridge's existence will deny the port in Neum from ever being able to upgrade itself to handle those kinds of huge container and cruise ships in the future. And so, the Bosnian government's official position is that the bridge was unilaterally constructed by the Croatians over what they regard as international waters. While the Croatian perspective is that they built the bridge fully within Croatia's own territorial waters and that they therefore didn't need to seek out the Bosnian government's approval in order to do it, and that the bridge still allows all pre-existing Bosnian maritime shipping to continue anyway, effectively leading to a kind of territorial dispute where the Bosnian government rejects to the existence of Croatia's bridge here rather than any territory. And yet, Croatia maintains yet another fairly minor territorial dispute with another one of their neighbors, Serbia, right here at about 14 different individual locations across their border that generally follows along the Danube River. The dispute here stems from Serbia and Croatia's different interpretations of where the border between them along the Danube should actually be placed at. Serbia legally regards the Thalweg of the Danube Valley and the centerline of the river as it currently flows today to be the border between them, while Croatia differs from this view and insists on the border being exactly as it was back in the 19th century that follows the centerline of the Danube River as it used to historically flow before the advent of hydrotechnical engineering works altered the Danube's course to what it currently looks like now. These differences in opinion between them have left around 140 square kilometers of land territory across 14 separate areas along the Danube in open dispute between them, which is nearly the same size as the microstate of Liechtenstein. But since nobody seemingly actually lives in any of these disputed territories, it doesn't rise up to a more serious dispute. As it currently stands now, Serbia controls most of the territories that are in dispute, with all 10 of these yellow highlighted areas east of the current flow of the Danube claimed by Croatia but controlled by Serbia. Meanwhile, because Croatia claims the border as the historical flow of the Danube River from the 19th century, it has led to an interesting situation where there are three small territories west of the current flow of the Danube River that Croatia does not legally claim and insists are Serbian instead, but which Serbia rejects and insists are Croatian, which means that these three small pockets of land along the Danube are all currently unclaimed by any nation on Earth, and represent the only currently unclaimed lands in Europe. This situation led to an eccentric Czech libertarian politician named Vít Jedlička to begin claiming the largest piece of unclaimed land here, about the same size as Gibraltar, for his self-declared Free Republic of Liberland. And he has reportedly been arrested by Croatian authorities multiple times for attempting to enter the land. But as it has stood for decades now, Croatia cannot claim these three small territories west of the Danube without giving up its bigger and more important claims to the larger territories east of the river. And since Serbia won't ever claim them either, they're likely to remain in a weird legal gray zone for the foreseeable future. Another weird sort of gray zone territory in the Balkans can be found here, a small exclave of Bosnian territory known as Rudo, home to around 173 people who are completely surrounded by Serbia. Weirdly, the border here only appears on maps like Google and Apple, and there aren't any border crossings or markings or checkpoints to even suggest that a border even exists there at all on the map. Even though the territory is universally recognized as belonging to Bosnia and Herzegovina, and all of its residents reportedly even pay their taxes to the government of Bosnia and Herzegovina, all of the day-to-day administration of the territory is handled by the Serbian government instead, blurring the line here between whether or not the small territory is recognized as Bosnian or Serbian. And it's not even the only territory in Europe that's like this, where the residents have a blurry sense of what country they might belong to. Over in the Iberian Peninsula, there's this relatively small territory known as Olivenza. It's about 430 square kilometers in area, larger than Malta, and home to around 12,000 residents and administered by Spain, but legally disputed in its entirety by neighboring Portugal as well. The history of this dispute goes a ways back. But basically, Olivenza was continually under Portuguese rule for centuries ever since they took it over from the Crown of Castile, all the way back in the year 1297. Half a millennium later, in 1801, however, things changed when the Spanish invaded Portugal and then forced the Portuguese to cede over Olivenza to them in the 1801 Treaty of Badajoz, which included an article that explained that the treaty would be cancelled if any of its other articles were violated, such as either Portugal or Spain attacking each other again in the future. So then, just 6 years later, in 1807, Spain and Napoleonic France jointly invaded Portugal again, which Portugal claims cancelled out the previous 1801 Treaty of Badajoz that ceded over Olivenza. Further, Article 105 of the later Treaty of Vienna that laid out the borders of Europe after Napoleon's overthrow, which Spain signed in 1817, compelled Spain to return Olivenza back to Portugal again. But then, for more than 200 years since then, Spain just kinda never did that and has just kept holding on to Olivenza anyway, arguing that they felt that the treaty's language didn't make their return of Olivenza explicitly mandatory. Since then, Portugal has never made a formal claim to the territory of Olivenza, which is why it's not marked as a disputed territory in Google Maps. But Portugal has also never directly acknowledged Spain's sovereignty over Olivenza either, making it, in theory, a sort of gray zone territory. Portuguese military maps as recently as 2013 still do not show a border that separates Olivenza from Portugal. Well, it also seems that the dispute over the territory is so low-key that most Spanish citizens aren't even aware that it even exists at all. And it's been a fairly moot point anyway, since Spain and Portugal have each been in the EU for decades now, so it's not really a very serious issue. But Spain's continued control over Olivenza for centuries, despite signing treaties to give it back, will seem fairly hypocritical when it comes to Spain's other territorial dispute in Europe over Gibraltar, which takes us into the more moderate levels of territorial disputes in Europe that actually involve larger numbers of people or more serious national strategic interests. Gibraltar is a British overseas territory and city at the southern tip of the Iberian Peninsula that, while small, is very densely populated with around 34,000 people today who are all British citizens. Gibraltar was first captured by the British from Spain more than three centuries ago, back in 1704 during the War of the Spanish Succession, which led Spain to agree on ceding Gibraltar to the UK under the terms of the 1713 Treaty of Utrecht that ended that war. Spain then attempted to recapture Gibraltar by force with a siege in 1727, and another very long siege between 1779 and 1783 during the American Revolutionary War, neither of which were successful and which resulted in subsequent treaties in 1729 and 1783 that all reaffirmed Britain's continued sovereignty over Gibraltar. The issue then remained fairly dormant for nearly another two centuries until Spain's dictator Francisco Franco reopened Spain's territorial claims to Gibraltar again in the 1960s, which have generally continued through to the present day. In theory, the Spanish government has sought to return the whole of Gibraltar back to their country through diplomacy since the Franco era of the 60s, but Spain hasn't ever claimed the entirety of Gibraltar's territory throughout this process. Instead, Spain has based its current territorial claims to Gibraltar on the exact language used within the original 1713 Treaty of Utrecht that ceded the territory over to Britain, which they argue covered only the fortified perimeter of the town of Gibraltar as it existed back at that time, which followed this line immediately to the north of the geographic Rock of Gibraltar. Spain argues that none of the territory to the north of this line was ever agreed to be ceded over to Britain by the Treaty of Utrecht, and argues that over the centuries since then, the British gradually expanded their area of control in Gibraltar north across the isthmus that connects Gibraltar to the Spanish mainland that formed the current de facto border. This has led to a situation where Spain today, as of 2024, formally claims this amount of territory in northern Gibraltar between where the current border is and the boundary Spain claims existed back in 1713, which notably includes the entire Gibraltar airport and the residences of around 4,200 people who live within Gibraltar's northern district, a claim that Brennan rejects on the grounds that, basically, they've continually controlled this land for centuries now, so it may as well stay British today. Which is also basically the same argument that Spain uses for its continued control of Olivenza. Moreover, Spain also insists that Britain's ownership over the rest of Gibraltar does not confer with it any usual territorial waters that would be granted under international law. Spain insists that Britain's only territorial waters around Gibraltar are extremely limited to being immediately within the port of Gibraltar and no further, while the UK insists on their usual territorial waters around Gibraltar that would be granted under international maritime law, which leads to all of these waters around Gibraltar being disputed between the UK and Spain as well. And with both of these territorial and maritime disputes around Gibraltar remaining active, Spain has spent decades attempting to negotiate with the UK on getting back the rest of Gibraltar as well. Spain's argument has been historically based on two points: that Britain's control of Gibraltar violates Spain's territorial integrity, and that Gibraltar's population of British citizens today are settlers and a product of British colonialism, which is why Spain refuses to consider the interests or opinions of any of Gibraltar's residents today, and insists on negotiating the status of the territory exclusively with the UK government itself. Britain's perspective, meanwhile, is based on the principle of self-determination for the 32,000 residents of Gibraltar today, who time and time again have shown in referendums and votes that they overwhelmingly prefer to remain a part of the UK. And the British government refuses to negotiate with Spain on the issue without the inclusion and representation of the Gibraltar government as an equal party. And Britain has consistently rejected all of Spain's various attempts to negotiate on Gibraltar's status for decades now. The dispute has also gotten even more controversial since 2020, when the UK left the European Union, which took Gibraltar along with it, which established a more firm land border crossing between the EU and the UK. All of which elevates the Gibraltar dispute to something a bit more moderate in intensity. Next up, we're going back to Croatia again, because oh man, if you thought Croatia was done with its border disputes or blocking its neighbors' access to the ocean, you were very wrong. In addition to their disputes with Montenegro, Serbia, and Bosnia and Herzegovina, Croatia's other modern territorial dispute is with Slovenia, and is centered on this little sliver of disputed land between them near to the Gulf of Pirin. The Croatian claim here is that the border follows the course of the Dragonia River as it flows today, while the Slovenian claim is that the border runs just a bit further to the southwest along the historical boundaries between them that used to exist in the 19th century, in a claim that'll sound familiar to the argument that Croatia itself makes with Serbia along their border that follows the Danube River. The result is a small, narrow strip of disputed land between Croatia and Slovenia in the middle of their claims that includes a few houses and farms, and notably, the Casino Hotel Mulino, a luxury 5-star hotel and casino with hundreds of highly rated Google reviews, whose website claims is located within Croatia, but whose entire property is marked as being disputed by Slovenia in Google Maps. The land dispute itself isn't extremely controversial, but the maritime dispute that it causes in the nearby Gulf of Pirin certainly is. Because of their different interpretations of where the border on land lies, Croatia claims that the maritime border extends from the mouth of the Dragonia River across the center of the Gulf of Pirin, dividing the gulf evenly between them and Slovenia, which happens to restrict Slovenia's territorial waters to just this narrow inlet immediately around their own small coastline, and which also blocks off Slovenia's direct access to international waters. Slovenia, meanwhile, counter-insists that the maritime border actually follows their land claim along the entire southern coast of the Bay of Pirin to the Cape here, and then extends out to about here in order to grant Slovenia direct access to international waters without them needing to pass through Croatian or Italian territorial waters first, and which also places the entire Gulf of Pirin within the claimed territorial waters of Slovenia. This situation led to a hotly contested area of disputed waters between them that got so contentious, Slovenia actually threatened to block Croatia's accession into the European Union for years over it until they agreed on resolving it. In 2011, both Croatia and Slovenia finally agreed that they would submit the dispute to the UN's Permanent Court of Arbitration to reach a final decision, and Slovenia ended its blockade of Croatia's membership into the European Union, leading to Croatia joining the EU in 2013. But then, several years later in 2017, the Permanent Court of Arbitration issued its final ruling on the disputed border that looked like this, essentially drawing the maritime border in between Croatia and Slovenia's respective claims, and connecting Slovenian territorial waters to a neutral corridor through which Croatia would have to grant universal passage to Slovenia through in order to grant Slovenia uninterrupted access to international waters. The Slovenian government hailed the agreement and accepted the ruling, but the Croatian government immediately refused it and stated that it wouldn't accept the results. Based on their allegations, the Slovenian government officials were improperly in contact with the members of the UN's arbitration court before the ruling was announced, and their assertion that the ruling was biased towards a pro-Slovenian outcome as a result, which leaves the waters in the Gulf of Piran and the land area along the Dragonia River disputed between Croatia and Slovenia to this day. Keeping us in the Balkans for now, another long-running dispute has to do with North Macedonia. Not with any of the country's territory, but with the very name that the country chooses to call itself by. For decades after gaining its independence from Yugoslavia in 1991, this country officially referred to itself as the Republic of Macedonia, or just Macedonia for short, which has triggered a long-running dispute with neighboring Greece, who strongly objected to their use of the label Macedonia. The dispute arose from the historical ambiguities around the creation of the Socialist Republic of Macedonia during the Yugoslav era, the emergence of a separate South Slavic Macedonian ethnic identity throughout the 20th century, the existence of the ancient Greek Kingdom of Macedon, and the contemporary geographic region of Macedonia within Greece, where a significant number of ethnic Greeks identify as Macedonians, and view themselves as being completely different from the South Slavic people who identify as ethnic Macedonians. Because of these complexities, Greece long argued that without a geographical qualifier like North Macedonia, the state of Macedonia could theoretically maintain territorial claims to the whole contemporary region of Macedonia, including territory in Greece, Bulgaria, and Albania, while they further accused the Macedonians of appropriating Greek culture and symbols like Alexander the Great. In order to even join the United Nations in 1993, Greece essentially forced the country to adopt the provisional name of the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, or the FYROM, instead of the Republic of Macedonia name that it preferred to use. While Greece continually blocked the country's admission into either the EU or NATO until the whole country would agree on changing its name. And for decades, they refused to consider changing their name, and this diplomatic deadlock continued all the way up until 2018, when the two sides finally agreed on a compromise, wherein Macedonia would formally change their name to North Macedonia, and Greece would drop their blockages of the country into the EU and NATO in exchange. The following year, in 2019, Macedonia formally changed its name to North Macedonia. And in 2020, the country was finally admitted into NATO. But that wasn't exactly the end of the dispute. The most recent election in North Macedonia in 2024 delivered a new nationalist candidate to the presidency, who immediately caused a diplomatic row with Greece when, during her inauguration speech, she deliberately referred to the country by the old name of just Macedonia again. Then, in June of 2024, the new nationalist North Macedonian Prime Minister repeatedly referred to the country as just Macedonia during a speech to the country's parliament, and blatantly said that he referred to the new name of North Macedonia as a shameful capitulation. All of this has led to the Greek government to recently say that they don't believe the North Macedonian government is serious about the name change, and that they'll go right back to blocking the country's accession into the European Union until they're satisfied that they're actually taking the name change more seriously, which makes it appear that the long-running dispute over this country's name hasn't yet ended. And this gets us into the final category of disputed territories and borders in Europe, the serious disputes that involve major areas of land, core strategic interests, and/or very large numbers of people that actually have a potential to escalate into conflict or even outright war, or in which active wars are already being fought over them. The first such territory in this final list of serious disputes in Europe keeps us in the Balkans and concerns the status of Kosovo, which, depending on who you ask at the present, is either a fully independent country or a rebellious province of Serbia. A serious dispute that involves nearly 11,000 square kilometers of territory and nearly 1.6 million people who live there. Kosovo used to be an autonomous province of Serbia for decades throughout the Yugoslav era, with a large population of both ethnic Albanians and Serbs, with internal Yugoslav demographic data from the 1950s and 60s showing that Albanians constituted around 65% of the population back then, and Serbs and Montenegrins around another 25%. But during Yugoslavia's collapse in the 1990s, the nationalist government of Serbia, headed by Slobodan Milosevic, began suppressing and eliminating Kosovo's former autonomy, which led to the emergence of the Albanian-dominated Kosovo Liberation Army, or KLA. Began waging an armed insurgency against the Serbian government in Kosovo after 1996 that sought Kosovo's outright independence through force. Violence in Kosovo between the KLA and the Serbian government continued to escalate until 1998, when the building tensions exploded into a full-scale war in the territory that eventually included the Serbian government's attempt to ethnically cleanse Kosovo of hundreds of thousands of its Albanian residents, and NATO's decision to intervene against Serbia militarily in 1999. That included a bombing campaign that eventually compelled the Serbian army to withdraw from Kosovo and led to tens of thousands of NATO troops entering into Kosovo in their place, as either peacekeepers or occupiers, depending on your perspective. The 1998-99 war dramatically shifted Kosovo's internal demographics. More than 13,000 people were killed during the Kosovo War, and around 850,000 Albanians had been forcefully expelled from Kosovo at gunpoint by the Serbian army and paramilitaries. And NATO facilitated most of their return to their territory in the aftermath of 1999. While harsh reprisal attacks from the Albanians on the Serb community in Kosovo led to the exodus of around 200,000 Serbs from Kosovo as refugees into the rest of Serbia in the immediate aftermath, which nearly eliminated Kosovo's large Serb minority and led to Kosovo being over 90% ethnically Albanian today, which some have argued represented another ethnic cleansing of Kosovo's Serb population. Kosovo was then placed under a transitional UN administration that authorized NATO to maintain its peacekeeping force in the territory. And then nearly a decade later in 2008, Kosovo unilaterally declared its independence from Serbia, which has remained unrecognized by the Serbian government to this day and is deeply contentious, with nobody so far having managed to reach a diplomatic solution to the dispute. Some recent negotiations to finally reach some solution have included Kosovo granting its remaining Serb population of around 100,000 in the north their full autonomy within Kosovo in exchange for legal recognition of independence from Serbia, or a territorial and population exchange scheme where Kosovo would cede its remaining Serb-majority areas in the north to Serbia in exchange for Serbia ceding some Albanian-majority areas in the east over to Kosovo, and extending its legal recognition of Kosovo's independence. But so far, neither of these ideas have been implemented, and they each have their various problems. And so, no solution has yet been reached. But since Kosovo's 2008 independence declaration, around 104 UN member states have chosen to legally recognize Kosovo's independence, including the United States and most of its allies in Europe and the Pacific, while Russia and China, along with the other BRICS members India, Brazil, South Africa, and Iran, in addition to Serbia, have all chosen to take Serbia's side in the dispute and have rejected Kosovo's independence, leading to Kosovo's legal status being hotly contentious on the international stage as well. Interestingly, there are even several EU and NATO countries that reject Kosovo's independence as well, including Spain, Slovakia, Romania, and Greece. Spain rejects Kosovo's independence out of fear of the precedent Kosovo's unilateral independence declaration might set for Catalonia, while Slovakia and Romania reject Kosovo's independence out of a similar fear of the precedent it could set for their own large Hungarian minorities. And Greece rejects Kosovo's independence out of the fear of the precedent it could set for the next serious territorial dispute in Europe in Cyprus. Cyprus is an island in the eastern Mediterranean that is these days de facto divided between three different entities: the ethnically Greek-majority Republic of Cyprus in the south, the ethnically Turkish-majority Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, or TRNC, in the north, and two sovereign British military bases in the south and the east, while the Greek-majority Republic of Cyprus claims all of the territory on the island that's controlled by the TRNC, and considers it all as legally occupied. This situation arose shortly after Cyprus was granted its independence from the British in 1960, At the time, owing to previous centuries of both Ottoman and Greek influence on the island, Cyprus was an ethnically mixed society where about 78% of the total population were Greeks, and another 18% of the population were Turks. A very convoluted government was set up by the British in post-independent Cyprus that was designed to try and enable the Greeks and the Turks on the island to share power, but it really just ultimately led to conflict between them instead. At the time, the Greeks of Cyprus generally favored a full union and annexation of the entire island with Greece, but the Turks of Cyprus generally favored a partition of the island, with the more Turkish-majority northern areas separating and potentially joining with Turkey. But both of these concepts were firmly rejected by both the UK and Turkey alike. And so, Cyprus's original constitution was drafted by all of them as a sort of compromise to explicitly forbid Cyprus from either joining Greece or partitioning itself in half, intended to keep Cyprus both whole and non-aligned. Regardless, ethnic tensions on the island between the Greek and Turkish communities continued, and eventually, a military junta government in Greece sponsored a coup in Cyprus in 1974 that installed a pro-Greece annexation government into power on the island, which Turkey flatly rejected as a violation of Greece's previous agreement to do exactly not that. And so then, Turkey decided to launch an amphibious invasion of Cyprus shortly afterwards that resulted in the Turkish army coming to occupy about the northern third of the island, that resulted in the mass expulsion of ethnic Greeks from the north to the south of the island, and ethnic Turks who were expelled from the south to the north. Eventually, the two sides agreed on a ceasefire, and the UN set up a buffer zone across the entire island that has kept the Greek and Turkish communities on Cyprus separated by a wall and soldiers ever since. Years later, in 1983, the Turkish-occupied area of northern Cyprus unilaterally declared their independence from the Republic of Cyprus as the TRNC, which to date has only ever been legally recognized as an independent country by Turkey itself, while the Republic of Cyprus has continually maintained that that declaration was illegal, and continues to claim all of the TRNC's controlled territory. And since Turkey's 1974 invasion, they've made the situation even more controversial by allowing tens of thousands of Turkish settlers from the mainland to move into the TRNC. So many so that currently it's estimated that about half of the TRNC's total population today in 2024 are made up of Turkish settlers or their descendants who are new to the island since 1974. This is a hugely controversial issue within both the Republic of Cyprus and Greece, who each reject the TRNC's unilateral independence declaration, and who also both maintain that in order to finally resolve the Cyprus dispute, all, or at least most of the Turkish settlers and their descendants who have moved to the island since 1974, have to be expelled. Which the Turks refuse because that would probably be half of the TRNC's population and result in a huge refugee exodus back to Turkey. This is also a huge part of why a referendum on reunification hosted across Cyprus in 2004 had such radically different voting patterns between the Turks and the Greeks on the island, where 65% of Turks on the island voted in favor of reunification, while 76% of Greeks on the island rejected reunification, largely because the terms of the reunification referendum in 2004 did not include an expulsion of any of the post-1974 Turkish settlers. Almost immediately after that referendum, the Republic of Cyprus was formally admitted into the European Union, and ever since, the north of the island has been considered to be the only part of EU territory that's under foreign military occupation. All negotiations on the reunification of Cyprus have failed ever since, owing to the Greeks' opposition to the status of Turkish settlers, and the Turks' fears of a tyranny by the majority and a potential ethnic cleansing. And so the island has remained de facto divided, with the UN still patrolling the border between them, and the Turkish military still remaining present in the north, and with the south maintaining its claim to all of the north recognized by virtually all of the international community, and the north asserting its independence only recognized by Turkey. The dispute over the status of Cyprus also extends out into the maritime theater as well. Turkey maintains a very unique argument in international maritime law, which asserts that no islands, including Cyprus, can be entitled to the usual 200 nautical mile EEZ ascribed to states by international UN maritime law. Turkey's unique legal view is that islands should only be entitled to 12 nautical mile territorial waters and no EEZ, while EEZs should only be granted to continental coastal territories. Based on that argument and belief, Turkey's claimed EEZ in the Eastern Mediterranean looks like this, while Cyprus's EEZ claim that's based on the UN's laws looks like this, which leads to a huge maritime area around Cyprus claimed by both Cyprus and Turkey alike. Moreover, the TRNC also claims for itself this huge EEZ area that looks like this, which leads to another huge overlapping area of maritime claims between the Republic of Cyprus and the TRNC, which has gotten even more contentious recently as major natural gas fields have been discovered in the area since the 2010s, and Turkey has begun drilling for more natural gas within the waters they dispute with Cyprus, leading to frequent clashes between the Cypriot and Turkish governments and the international community. And it's not even the only large and strategically important maritime dispute maintained by Turkey, because they have an even bigger and even more controversial maritime dispute with their neighbor Greece within the Aegean Sea. Because the UN grants states the right to territorial waters up to 12 nautical miles from all of their coastlines, and because Greece has so many islands dotted all throughout the Aegean, if Greece applied the customary 12 nautical mile rule here, they would effectively come to possess the entire Aegean as a Greek-dominated territorial sea that would heavily restrict Turkey's Aegean coastline from access to international waters, which Turkey has for decades argued is unfair in the interest of equity. Instead, Turkey has effectively pressured the Greeks into a status quo arrangement in the Aegean, where both sides only recognize a 6 nautical mile limit of territorial waters instead of the more customary 12 nautical miles that looks like this. While Turkey has frequently threatened war with Greece over the decades if they ever decide to unilaterally extend their territorial waters in the Aegean up to the UN-recognized 12 nautical mile limit. The dispute also extends out from territorial waters into an EEZ dispute as well. Remember, the Turkey uniquely argues that islands cannot have their own EEZ areas and only continental landmasses can have them instead, which leads Turkey to claim the eastern half of the Aegean Sea as its own EEZ along the median line between the Turkish and Greek mainlands that ignores all of Greece's islands in the Aegean as far as EEZ claims go, with Turkey only recognizing the island's small 6 nautical mile territorial waters. Turkey views this policy as something more fair that divides the Aegean and its resources more evenly between themselves and Greece, and which also gives them more breathing space, while Greece views it differently as a covert Turkish attempt to encircle their easternmost islands, some of which are heavily populated like Rhodes, Lesbos, and Chios, which would all be much harder to defend during a wartime scenario if surrounded by Turkish waters. Turkey argues that tiny Greek-controlled islands like Kastellorizo that barely have a population of more than 500 people shouldn't be entitled to a huge EEZ area like this that blocks off the Turkish mainland. And so, you ultimately have a huge area of the Aegean Sea and the Eastern Mediterranean that are hotly disputed between Greece, who claims themselves an EEZ based on the UN's rules that enable islands to have full EEZs, and Turkey, who uniquely claims that islands cannot possess EEZs and that EEZs can only be determined by continental landmasses. And then, we arrive at all of the various territorial disputes across the former Soviet Union, of which there are very, very many. In Moldova, there's a narrow strip of land that follows between the Dniester River in the west and the border with Ukraine in the east that is de facto under the control of an entity that calls itself Transnistria, which is disputed and claimed entirely by the government of Moldova. Moldova used to be a Soviet republic, and when the Soviet Union was collapsing in 1991, the region of Transnistria, which had a high ethnically mixed population of Russians, Moldovans, and Ukrainians, unilaterally declared their independence from Moldova with the intention of trying to remain within the Soviet Union, and later within Russia. A brief 3-month-long war was fought between them in 1992 that saw Russia directly supporting the Transnistrian side, in which a few hundred people were killed before a ceasefire was agreed upon that kept Transnistria de facto independent, but legally unrecognized by any other country in the world. A situation that remains unresolved and frozen to this day. There's a little over 360,000 people who live within Transnistria today, and Russia has maintained a permanent troop deployment of around 1,500 soldiers to the territory, which led to the Council of Europe ruling in 2022 that Transnistria was legally Moldovan territory under Russian military occupation. And that, of course, is not the only territory to have fallen under that classification recently. As the Soviet Union was disintegrating in the 1990s, two ethnic minorities in the Soviet Republic of Georgia, the Abkhaz and the Ossetians, began fighting against the Georgian government for their own independence as well. They were both directly supported by the Russian government, that resulted in both of their de facto independences. The war in Abkhazia across 1992 and 93 was especially brutal, with as many as 30,000 people killed throughout the conflict and severe human rights abuses that were perpetrated by every side involved, and ended with a mass ethnic cleansing campaign of the territory's ethnic Georgians that saw around 250,000 of them get expelled out of Abkhazia into the rest of Georgia. Later in 2008, fighting between these separatist-controlled regions and the Georgian government flared up once again, which led to the Russian army launching a full-scale invasion of Georgia that saw the entirety of Abkhazia and South Ossetia both falling under Russian military occupation, or protection depending on your point of view again, with Russia harking back to the precedent set by NATO's intervention into Kosovo against Serbia to justify its own intervention into Abkhazia and South Ossetia against Georgia. Russia has since gone on to legally recognize Abkhazia and South Ossetia's independence, has established military bases throughout both of them, and has increasingly integrated both territories ever closer to Russia, both economically and politically, which has led to Georgia, along with the EU, Turkey, Ukraine, the US, UK, Canada, Australia, China, Japan, and the UN, to all formally classify the territories as being under Russian military occupation, which represents roughly 20% of Georgia's internationally recognized territory as under Russian occupation. And then, of course, the 2008 Russian invasion and occupation of about 20% of Georgia's internationally recognized territory seems almost like a dress rehearsal in hindsight for what would later come to Ukraine, which is indisputably the site of the most controversial territorial dispute in Europe today and probably in the entire world. In 2014, Russia invaded the territories of Crimea and Sevastopol and unilaterally annexed them both into Russia, which has been disputed by Ukraine and most of the international community for the past decade ever since. And then, in 2022, Russia launched an all-out military invasion of Ukraine that is continuing more than 2.5 years later. Since that invasion, Russia has gone on to unilaterally declare the annexations of 4 additional entire Ukrainian provinces as well: Luhansk, Donetsk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson, which together with Crimea and Sevastopol represent roughly 20% of Ukraine's internationally recognized territory, about the same size as Austria, that Russia all claims for itself, and that was all home to a pre-war population of nearly 12 million people, a massive area and population disputed between them. Recent official Russian government-issued maps show all of these territories as fully belonging to Russia, and Russia's currently stated war objectives in Ukraine are to secure all of their full control. But as it currently stands, there are still significant amounts of the Donetsk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson provinces that still remain under Ukrainian control and that the Russians are still attempting to conquer. And so far, Ukraine has not surrendered or compromised and continues to claim all of these territories overran by Russia since 2014, including Crimea. Adding up both sides' losses together since the invasion of 2022 began, it's currently estimated that more than 1 million soldiers have been killed or wounded by the war over these territories, while tens of thousands of Ukrainian civilians have also been killed at a minimum, while more than 6 million Ukrainians are also believed to have fled the country due to the fighting since 2022. All of which has marked the deadliest and largest-scale conflict in Europe seen since the Second World War, and the largest refugee crisis seen globally during the entire 21st century. All of which makes the disputed territories in Ukraine, arguably, the most controversial and deadliest in the entire world today. All in all, these are all of the territories across Europe that are currently disputed as of today in 2024. But there are many other territories that might fall into disputes in the future, and many others that have only very recently been tenuously resolved. Most of the territories in eastern Ukraine, outside of small pro-Russian separatist areas in Donetsk and Luhansk, were not openly in dispute until they very suddenly were, starting in 2022. And more than a million people have been killed and injured fighting over them since then. Territorial disputes are often fluid and can both end and begin very suddenly. And one of the most recently resolved major territorial disputes on the continent that has the potential to flare back up again in the future concerns the status of Northern Ireland, a part of the United Kingdom that for decades up until very recently in 1998 was wholly claimed and disputed by the Republic of Ireland's government. Leading up to that point, for about three decades between the 1960s and the end of the 1990s, the political status and future of Northern Ireland as a part of the United Kingdom triggered one of modern Europe's longest-running insurgencies and violent conflicts in which thousands of people were killed and tens of thousands of others were wounded, many with life-altering, debilitating injuries. The conflict was waged between Irish Republican paramilitaries like the IRA, who wanted to see Northern Ireland leave the UK and join with the Republic of Ireland, and Loyalist and Unionist paramilitaries along with the British State Security Forces, who wanted to maintain Northern Ireland's British status. The conflict involved major assassination attempts on members of the British royal family and even the British Prime Minister, the largest bombing seen in Britain since the Second World War, and an oftentimes heavy-handed British counterinsurgency campaign that led to brutal incidents like Bloody Sunday, in which British soldiers shot into an unarmed crowd of Irish protesters and killed 14 of them and never faced any legal consequences. The whole history of the Northern Ireland conflict, often referred to as the Troubles, is vital to understanding the context that led to the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, when the Republic of Ireland finally agreed to renounce its territorial claim to Northern Ireland, and why the questions over Northern Ireland's ultimate status have begun to return back to the international stage again today in the 2020s, in a post-Brexit world where the UK has withdrawn from the European Union and taken Northern Ireland along with it. Since then, Catholics in Northern Ireland, for the very first time in the territory's entire history, became a demographically larger group than Protestants in 2021. And earlier in 2024, Michelle O'Neill made history when she became the first ever Irish nationalist to be elected as Northern Ireland's first minister. And she has since stated that she fully expects a referendum on Northern Ireland's reunification with the Republic of Ireland to be hosted sometime within the next decade. Understanding the events that took place during the Troubles in Northern Ireland is critically important to understanding the context of what's taking place in Northern Ireland, the UK, and in Europe today. But at the same time, we all know that if I made a very in-depth video covering the Troubles, the many, many disturbing, violent, and inherently controversial details of discussing a subject that crosses the line into recent incidents of terrorism and massacres would without a doubt cause the entire video to become demonetized and age-restricted, which I actually agree with and think is very appropriate. But it also ultimately means that YouTube's algorithm, which is designed to show you appropriate videos alongside of ads in order to make money, would never actually promote the video to you in your feed. Which means that there's just simply no way that you would ever see it here on this site at all. And that's why instead, I created yet another full-length companion video to this one in my ongoing Modern Conflict series that covers, to the best of my ability, the entire course of events and explanation into what took place throughout the period of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, involving now infamous organizations like the Irish Republican Army or the IRA. And I uploaded it directly to Nebula, where you can go and watch it right now. As I'm sure you've probably already heard by now, Nebula is the home of tons of exclusive ad-free content like my entire Modern Conflict series, with more than 30 other full-length exclusive videos over there that you can go and watch right now, covering dozens of recent major wars and conflicts that'll help you stay up to date on what's going on across our world and why. From all of these videos covering the ongoing Russian invasion of Ukraine, to these other episodes covering Russia's other wars in Georgia, Chechnya, and Transnistria, to this massive episode covering the collapse of Yugoslavia, and many, many others with brand new episodes releasing every single month. And even better, I also recently started another completely new monthly series on Nebula called War Room, which will track all of the latest breaking geopolitical news developing from conflicts around the world and break them down into a single, easily digestible monthly video briefing series that'll help you stay even more up to date and informed on what's currently happening around the world and why. The latest episode in War Room, covering all of the breaking geopolitical news and developments from last month in September, including Israel's war on Hezbollah and their bombing campaign in Lebanon, is live on Nebula for you to go and watch right now. And new episodes will be released every single month, just like the monthly new episodes in Modern Conflicts have been, meaning two new exclusive real-life lore videos on Nebula that you won't find on YouTube, going out every month going forward. And what's even more, you also get access to all of the other amazing exclusive content that's on Nebula. Because the best part about this site is that it's jointly co-owned by all of its creators. Built by me and hundreds of other independent YouTubers and podcasters. And because it's a subscription-based service, we all get to work on way bigger and higher budget productions over there than we could ever do on our own on YouTube. That's why there's tons of other exclusive content that you'll find equally fascinating from all of these other creators over there you probably also already know as well. And best of all, if you sign up by clicking the button that's here on your screen right now, or scan the QR code, or by following the link down below in the description, you'll receive an insane 40% discount off of an annual subscription. Which means it'll only cost you $3 a month or $36 a year for all of this awesome exclusive content from myself and hundreds of other independent creators with even more stuff getting added every single month. It's the absolute best way to help support what I'm doing here on Real Life Lore, and as always, thank you so much for watching.